You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk, and I'm Jose Dras Lopez. Rob Burris is an evolutionary psychologist who studies how human mate retention and mate choice behaviors relate to face perception, hormonal contraceptive use, and other factors. He received his PhD in 2007 from the University of Liverpool, and he has held postdocs at the University of Stirling and Penn State. He produces the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast, a witty and erudite monthly update on interesting research. We spoke on Skype. Here's our conversation.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jose.
We're really talking about people being attracted to each other.
That's right, yeah.
There's a funny contrast between looking at things scientifically and then thinking about what it means in daily life.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, often I'll give a departmental seminar, you know, in front of some general researchers in my field, say in anthropology or biology, and I'll use a term like mate value or like mate market, and people start to think that I'm, you know, maybe like treating people like animals or something like that. And it's difficult. You get used to using these terms and you know what they mean, but sometimes they can sound like they mean something else. And that can be tricky sometimes when you're trying to get across what you do in an area like this that kind of has got a bit of a sensitivity for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone could hear mate market and think of prostitution.
Exactly, or because often you're talking about mate choice, one sex choosing another sex, it can sound like, okay, well, you know, if someone's in the mate market, do people have control over their destiny? And are we sort of saying that people are being traded? Yeah, it's tricky sometimes. So you've got to watch it. You've got to maybe think about how you're describing your research sometimes to make sure that people get the right idea, you know?
Yeah. Well, in our conversation, I'll give you a pass. Use all the jargon you want, and we will assume you're a great person.
Okay. Excellent. Or you can pull me up on it. You know, you can just say, what the heck are you talking about? And I'll try and make myself clear.
Okay. I'd like to talk about the pill, as it's called, or hormonal contraceptives.
Yeah.
Because there's a bit of a scare that's made it through the news in the last few years about their side effects, psychologically speaking or behaviorally speaking. So tell us about what contraceptives do to women and potentially to their relationships, for example, affecting jealousy.
Yeah, okay. Of course, the contraceptive pill has been around for over 50 years now. And a really huge number of women worldwide use it. I think it's something like 8 or 9% of women of childbearing age worldwide use the contraceptive pill. A couple more percent use other hormonal contraceptives, but not so many. And I think it's something like 80% of American women of all ages have used the pill at some time during their life in the last 50 years. So it's a really commonly used drug. But not many of the psychological side effects have been investigated. So a lot of physical side effects have been identified, and women are warned about these when they start taking the pill. And a couple of psychological side effects, but very few of the possible side effects to do with how people choose mates, how they're attracted to other people, how it can affect behavior in that realm. Very few of those have been investigated, which is kind of odd because, of course, the pill, you know, it has progesterone substitutes in there, estrogen type hormones, they're sex hormones, so you might expect them to have some effect psychologically on sexual type behavior. So it's only been in the last couple of years, really, that we've started to look at whether some of those side effects do exist. And people who work in this area, me, my colleagues, some other researchers, have found that there may be some effects of the pill on jealousy. So I and a colleague of mine, Lisa Welling, a couple of years ago did some research on mate retention and pill use. Mate retention behaviors, that's kind of an umbrella term we use to describe any behavior that people might do to prevent their partner from being poached by someone else or to prevent their partner from straying and going off and finding a new partner. So it can go right from buying your partner some roses, so they'll think you're great, through to, you know, buying them a wedding ring, just generally being nice. Or it can, you know, be things like preventing your partner from going out to see their friends, right through to physical or verbal abuse of your partner or any potential rival. So these are what we call mate retention behaviors. And we found that women who use the pill tend to engage in more of these mate retention behaviors. They produce them more frequently than women who don't use the pill.
I have sort of a technical question about mate retention behaviors.
Sure, yeah.
Is intent important in the definition you're using for that study?
Sometimes these mate retention behaviors, they're kind of nice things to do, and sometimes they're not. But when people complete the mate retention inventory, which is the questionnaire that's been developed to test these behaviors, all they're really doing is saying, you know, here's a behavior that you might do. Say, for example, giving your partner a chain with your name on it or something like that. Have you done this in the last month? How frequently have you done a behavior like this? And that kind of thing. So intention, we don't ask them about that because I'm sure you know, people find it really difficult to accurately give information about their intentions. People don't always know why they do things. So some of these behaviors, they might have different unconscious aims, but taken over the whole list of tactics, we can sort of make an assumption that, okay, if someone's doing a lot of these things, they're probably the sort of person who is really worried about their partner leaving or their partner being snatched away by someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I guess I imagined a layperson reacting, well, how can you read people's minds and figure out what they're actually trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, of course you can't. You know, that's the tricky thing. You know, if you ask someone, are you worried about your partner leaving? A lot of people are just going to go, no, I'm not. I'm not worried about that, you know. Even if they are, you know, and it's difficult to really get at that sometimes. So if we just ask about behaviors, then hopefully you can get to tap that intention a little bit better than just asking them why they do things.
Okay, well, I interrupted you. So what happens, according to your study with Lisa Welling?
Okay, going back to the mate retention type findings, so we found that women who were on the pill, they engage in more mate retention behaviors, and specifically mate retention behaviors aimed at their partner as opposed to rivals. So women who are on the pill, they're not more likely to, say, confront potential rivals and say, hey, you know, are you looking at my guy? Are you, did you call my guy? You know, this kind of thing. They're more likely to, say, check their partner's cell phone or to perform sexual favors for their partners. That's one of the tactics that we have on the mate retention inventory that's aimed to partners as well. So those things are more likely when women are on the pill.
See, I think of the lay reaction to that. I think of men thinking, and now it's great that my partner's on the pill, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I say, there's positive mate retention tactics and there's negative ones too, you know? So if you think about, you know, some people, they want a partner who's a little bit jealous, but just not too jealous, if you see what I mean. So it's nice to know that your partner cares enough about the possibility that you might leave to be nice to you. You know, because if you think of a person who's completely confident that their partner's never going to leave them, they don't have to worry about it, they're so great, their partner's never going to want anyone else. Well, that kind of person, maybe they're not going to be the sort of person who chases their partner up and asks, you know, where were you last night? Or have you been seeing that other guy? But they're also not going to be the kind of guy who is nice to their partner because they don't need to be. Their partner's not going to leave. So there's a sort of seesaw effect here, I guess. You know, if people are worried about their partners leaving, they might do some nice things and some nasty things. So I don't think men should automatically wish their partners were on the pill just because there's a little chance they might get the odd extra sexual favor or anything like that.
Understood. Yeah, there's a delicate balance of different factors there. Okay, so that's the mate retention effect of the pill, and it's related to jealousy. There's some work that I sent you some links. It's not work you've done necessarily, but it's gotten attention that just the idea that maybe women on the pill aren't as interested in hypermasculine men, or there are other effects like that where maybe they like more the Orlando Bloom,
yeah,
Leonardo DiCaprio types.
Like you say, it's got a lot of attention in the media. Because, you know, people who work in the media know that lots of women take the pill. So, you know, if you write an article on that, you've got a huge audience for it, people who are going to be worried about it. You know, I take the pill, how's this affecting me? And then, you know, if they can put a couple of photos in of Johnny Depp or Orlando Bloom, then hey presto, they get lots of hits. So sometimes these findings get a lot more airplay than probably they should. None of this bad research, just that sometimes we need to do a bit more research on these areas to be absolutely 100% sure what's going on. So I want to be clear that we don't know exactly what's going on with this yet, but it looks like what happens is that what the pill does is it simulates the hormonal environment, internal environment that women have when they're later stages of their natural menstrual cycle. So you get sort of higher progesterone and lower estrogen. And this is sort of similar to the hormonal profile of someone who's pregnant as well. So these are the kind of preferences we see when people are on the pill. They're the kind of preferences that we also see in women when they're in the later non-fertile stages of their natural menstrual cycle and also during the stages of pregnancy. And so, yeah, we see that women with those hormonal profiles tend to be less attracted to hypermasculine men. And when women are in the fertile phase of their cycle, so that's around about day 14 of the cycle, if we're counting from, if day one is the first day of menses, so day 14, round about there, is when women ovulate and when they're most fertile. That's when we tend to see women having a stronger preference for masculine men, and not just facially masculine men, also men who've got more masculine voices, more masculine aggressive behavior. That's when women tend to find those men more attractive. And the hypothesis that we have about that, the reason why we think that might be happening, is that when women are in that fertile phase, that's when they can become pregnant. And these masculine guys, they're the ones with the best genes. They're the ones who you want, if you're a woman, to be the biological father of your children. But they might not be the best kind of guys to hang around with all the time, because they tend to have, like I say, they're more masculine, they're more aggressive. They might not be the type of people who would make great sort of partners, perhaps long-term partners, because they're less cooperative and more aggressive. So if women have a stronger preference for these guys when they can become pregnant, they reap the benefits of those good genes by becoming pregnant. But if they prefer these guys all the time, they'd have to deal with all the other hassles that come along with those type of guys. So it's what people hypothesize there, is that women have a kind of dual mating strategy. They're not as simple as men, in other words. You know, men tend to want a feminine woman in appearance and behavior all the time. Women are a bit more complicated than that, I guess, you know? It just depends what time of the month it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would, this is a clarification that's maybe not necessary, but there are many other things aside from what time of month it is that'll affect the woman's calculations or preferences,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe what life stage they're in, for example.
Yeah. So we also find when women are nearing the end of their reproductive lifespan at menopause, their preferences change again. And preferences during teenage years, they're sort of, they crank up to being more sort of typical what we see in adult students who are usually our participants. Yeah, of course, there's lots of other variables. And of course, it's not, you know, it's not like every time a woman reaches ovulation, she forgets about her feminine-faced long-term partner and dashes off looking for an Arnold Schwarzenegger lookalike or anything like that. This is just one of the factors that we know has an effect on preference. And when you add it up with lots of other effects, you know, that sort of all sums up to how women really behave in the real world.
I'm also interested in this idea of like the genetically better man, the one who's like more masculine, because I could see physically the argument would be that looking across our evolution, it would be desirable to have a man who was big and strong to fend off any sort of threats from other people, or and to help go on the hunt,
yeah,
and bring in lots of food. Mm-hmm. In addition, I don't think there's any inverse correlation between being hunky and masculine and intelligence. So it's not like you're sacrificing that much by,
yeah,
going out for the traditionally masculine man, right? So I guess that's the argument for why women can be attracted to that.
Well, there's different kinds of benefits that anyone gets from any kind of partner. So not just women, but also men. And you can have direct benefits and also indirect benefits. So the benefits you talk about there, like maybe if a woman chooses a more masculine guy, she's got someone who can protect her from adversaries or perhaps be a better hunter. That's one kind of benefit. But you've also got the genetic benefits, which is kind of different. You know, if you have a partner who has all those characteristics, you don't necessarily need to have a child with that partner to have those benefits. You know what I mean? If you're just living with that partner and they're protecting you against other dangerous people, then you've got that benefit. But if you mate with a partner who's got good genes, and we think that those men are also the masculine men, then the benefit is passed on to your offspring there, so you're more likely to have a healthy, strong child too. And I think you're right to say that masculine men probably aren't more intelligent than feminine men. And I think there is evidence to suggest that that's the case. But what we do know is that feminine men tend to be to spend more time with their offspring, and they're more likely to share any resources they do have with their partners. So if women want that from a partner, they're probably not going to get it from a masculine guy. And the reason why feminine men might be like that is because they know they're not as competitive in the mating market as a masculine man. So a masculine man, the reason why he can afford to be so aggressive and not to be so cooperative is because he knows he's got a better chance of securing more short-term relationships with a larger pool of women. A guy who's more feminine and perhaps hasn't got as good a genes to trade on, he hasn't got as many options in the mating market and therefore has to be nicer, if you see what I mean, to sort of play off against that, but perhaps that weakness that he has.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I'm interested, and again, this is a tangent, but very fascinating to me. Let's take the feminine man, or just more feminine men in general. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why their genes are less desirable in the child. Is there any correlation between health of immune system and masculinity, for example?
Yeah, so we see in other animals that females tend to prefer males who've got typically masculine traits, and those males will also be more healthy. And there is also some evidence that that's the case in men as well. So if you look at men's face shape and how masculine it is, there is some evidence that it links to their health. So I think respiratory diseases is one thing people have looked at, and just general health from health records. So the evidence isn't 100% solid, and there probably aren't as many studies on this as there should be, given that a lot of research is based their research on this kind of assumption that masculine men are more healthy. But there does seem to be some evidence that is the case. And the reason why that probably is the case is that testosterone acts as a kind of immunosuppressant. So if a feminine man were to increase his levels of testosterone and therefore build, say, a masculine physique and a masculine face, it wouldn't work because he'd get sick too soon. Because the testosterone would suppress his immune system. So in that respect, a masculine face is a really honest signal. Like, a man can't fake it. So it's an honest signal of his ability to withstand any sort of health knock or anything like that, any kind of illness. So a masculine man, if he's got a masculine face, it's like saying, hey, I've got, you know, I can afford to produce all this testosterone and it makes me look like this and I haven't even got sick.
It's sort of like the peacock's tail then.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. If a peacock has a really poor quality tail, it's because he just can't cope with the testosterone required to build that signal. And the females know that he's not really worth mating with because he hasn't got great genes. So we think that's what's going on with masculinity in men, and also with facial symmetry. So we see a similar relationship with facial symmetry. A man has a more symmetrical face if he's able to withstand environmental perturbations and illnesses and that kind of thing. So you can use it as an honest signal of his genetic quality.
That's very, very interesting. I'm just starting to appreciate this. I'm glad you're explaining it. It would never occur to me that the masculinity of a face was a signal of how much of a beating your body can take.
Of course, these aren't things that people consciously think when they look at someone. But evolution doesn't need to have provided us with the ability to consciously notice that. We can just go, okay, that's a masculine guy, and, you know, I may or may not find him attractive. But you don't need to know whether that's anything to do with health or anything like that for it to have an evolutionary effect.
Well, we're talking about testosterone so much that I want to talk about the effects of hormones in general and maybe illustrate with some extremes. So in the case of testosterone, you're saying that if a male adult who's effeminate is taking testosterone, it's going to make them sick. But the way it naturally works is, I guess, the amount of testosterone that an infant produces naturally affects how they develop. Tell us about what the life course of a very high testosterone boy would look like. They would have a deep voice and they'd broad-shouldered, I guess. But tell us a little more.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have heard about this fact that when boys are born, they have really, really high testosterone. And that's because, of course, when your body is being developed, it's sort of being sexualized at the same time. Your brain is being turned into a male brain and your body is being turned into a male body. So your testosterone is what really starts that off. And that's that's really high. And then it tails off during the early part of your childhood. And then when you hit puberty, that's when it skyrockets again. And so for different males, it'll be high. For different males, it'll be low. But there are the common correlates of high testosterone exposure that people are familiar with. So things like, you know, aggression. So the more testosterone that a man is exposed to, the more aggressive he's likely to be. And, you know, this makes sense if we think about aggression as something that drives competition. So if a man is high quality, high testosterone, it makes sense for him to be more aggressive. There's more chance of him winning contests. If he's got lower testosterone, less chance of winning contests, probably less point in being so aggressive. But testosterone, or high testosterone, is also really correlated with sex drive, and not just in men, but also in women. So women do have a certain small amount of testosterone. And like in men, the more testosterone they have, the stronger their sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see men, if they have a high amount of testosterone, they'll tend to be more predisposed to engage in short-term relationships, flings, one-night stands, that kind of thing. And as we go on later through life, we'll find that men who have higher testosterone, they're more likely to get divorced. So even if they manage to have a long-term relationship, it's more likely to end in divorce. So there are lots of things that are correlated with testosterone that we nowadays, in a modern Western society, we would think of as antisocial. But they're definitely things we can think of as conferring some kind of evolutionary advantage, definitely in our evolutionary history way back on the African savannah, but possibly also benefits that we could see today. You know, if a guy is having lots of partners and producing lots of offspring, you know, that's really what evolution cares about. Of course, we've got these things like, you know, we have the contraceptive pill and sexually transmitted diseases that may make it more difficult for a guy who's securing all those short-term relationships to survive and reproduce. Definitely high testosterone is something that's almost certainly been really useful for the men who've been able to withstand it in the past.
Right. And I guess it's worth emphasizing that evolutionary success, in scare quotes, is not the same thing as success in the value-laden way we talk about wanting to succeed in life. Evolutionary success can be being Genghis Khan and just pillaging villages and taking lots of women, sending your genes off into a large portion of the Asian population even to this day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's really, if we're talking about, you know, natural selection and evolution, the number of children who survive to reproductive age, you know, if you can maximize that number, then that's really, you know, it's kind of depressing, I guess, but that's really all evolution cares about. So anyone who can do that is succeeding in those terms, but perhaps not necessarily the terms that, yeah, we'd like to succeed in today for most of us.
Right, right. Understood. Well, we talked about testosterone and how that can affect a boy and then a man across his life. And I think it's worth looking at on the side of women. They have some testosterone, but part of what feminizes them is estrogen, right? So
yeah.
What would a high estrogen woman be like?
What we find is that women who've got high levels of estrogen, they'll tend to have typically feminine characteristics. So we know that it's related to high fertility. So women who have higher natural levels of estrogen, they're more likely to find it easy to get pregnant. And it also will affect body shape. So we also see that women who've got high levels of estrogen, they'll tend to have that typical hourglass figure. They're more likely to be able to naturally have that hourglass figure of what researchers sometimes term as the 0.7 waist to hip ratio. That's where your waist is about 70% as big as your hips. And people with that body shape are more likely to find it easy to get pregnant. And we find also that women with high estrogen, they'll have a more feminine face shape. And men highly value the feminine face shape. So generally, higher estrogen just means more feminized body shape and more attractive to men. And the reason why men find those feminine traits attractive, we think, is pretty much just because they're related to how easy it is a woman will find it to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm. So when men and women are looking at each other and unconsciously picking up on cues about the other's genes or their estrogen and testosterone, that has a lot to do with their face and their body shape, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in evolutionary terms, what men should be looking for in a partner is someone who will find it easy to get pregnant, because men are sort of not limited by the ability to produce only, say, one child every 9 or 10 months like women are. The more partners a man has, the more chance he has of spreading his genes throughout the population. So men are really keyed into those cues that are to do with fecundity or fertility. And those are just really evident in body shape. That's why we see men paying so much attention to faces and particularly to bodies for short-term relationships. Men do value body appearance more for short-term relationships than they do for long-term relationships.
Yeah. I would think, and this is just speculation, that there'd be even smaller things that would be harder to notice, like skin tone, that might be related to the same hormones, estrogen and testosterone. Actually, that reminds me to get back to the topic of the menstrual cycle. You were pointing out that women have mixed preferences for different types of men, and that can be influenced by what stage of a cycle they're in, whether they're ovulating or past that in the non-fertile part of their cycle. And they also appear a bit different to men, it seems, depending on what stage of their cycle they're in. So tell us about what evidence we have that men are unconsciously noticing when women are ovulating.
Okay, yeah. So what some of your listeners might have heard about human ovulation is that it's concealed, that unlike animals like chimpanzees, which in which the females advertise their fertile status with perineal swellings and that kind of thing.
By being in heat.
Yeah.
Estrus.
Yeah. By saying, hey guys, you know, I'm fertile right now. And the females get more interested in sex at that time. They become more proceptive. At first glance, well, women aren't like that. Humans aren't like that. We can't tell if a woman's in the fertile phase like we can in chimps or other primates. So maybe human ovulation is concealed. And that was thought to be the case for a long period of time. And it's only in the last sort of 5 or 6 years that we've really begun to look more closely at this and to find evidence for ovulation perhaps not being advertised, but one of the terms people use is that it's leaky, that we can go, oh, well, she's not advertising she's in the fertile phase, but I can tell somehow. And again, this isn't a conscious thing. Men, very rarely will a man look at a woman and go, you know, hey, I guess she's just ovulating just now. What we can sometimes tell is that women's attractiveness goes a little bit higher during the fertile phase of the cycle, and men are able to look at, say, photographs of women taken during their fertile phase and compare them to photographs taken during the non-fertile phase of the cycle and say, oh, this photograph's more attractive. I don't know why, but just this picture's more attractive. And then when we look at the averages of all those preferences, we find that, yeah, men are choosing the photographs of women when they're in the fertile phase of the cycle. Mm-hmm. And one thing I should probably point out is when I'm talking about the non-fertile phase of the cycle, I'm not necessarily talking about menses. A lot of people think that when I say the non-fertile phase of the cycle, or researchers say the non-fertile phase of the cycle, we mean during the period. We're not talking about that part of the cycle. We're talking about maybe sort of days 20, 22, 23 of the cycle, what we call the luteal phase. So sometimes when people hear sort of, oh, there's a difference between attractiveness of women in the fertile and the non-fertile phase, women will say, yeah, but during my period, I don't feel like, you know, doing my makeup or doing my hair as much. It's not, you know, I don't feel like wearing the types of clothes that I would wear a week or so later. But we're not necessarily talking about that part of the cycle. We're talking about it a little bit afterwards. So, but not only do we see differences in facial attractiveness, we see differences in the type of clothes women wear in the fertile phase. They tend to reveal more skin. They tend to spend more time on their makeup and on their hair. We see women's voices, I think, also get more attractive or higher pitched, which we know men find more attractive around about ovulation. Quite a few changes that happen in women's behavior and attractiveness that might leak out to men and say to men, I'm in the fertile phase of the cycle. Well, not necessarily say that to men, that men are able to pick up on it. Because what we do hypothesize is that women don't necessarily want men to know when they're in the fertile phase of the cycle, but it pays men to be able to work this out for themselves. Because if a man knows who's fertile, he knows who's more likely to become pregnant, and if he's given a choice of partners, who's the best person to pursue.
Right, that's fascinating. Did you mention movements and dance movements? Because that was very interesting to me.
Yeah, so like I say, people have looked at how women's attractiveness and behavior changes over the cycle, and they've looked at facial appearance, like I've mentioned. They've looked at voice and things like that. They've also looked at behavior. So a paper that came out a couple of years ago looked at whether women's gait was related to their fertility status. And in that paper, the researchers found that women were less attractive. Their walking style was less attractive when they're in the fertile phase of the cycle, which wasn't what I guess they originally expected to find. I think they did this research using one of those point light displays, you know, where you sort of put lights all over someone's body and then you film them against the black background. So you can't see the person, you can just see how they're walking.
Right, it's like watching a stick figure walking.
Yeah, exactly. So that their conclusion from that study was that, hey, maybe what women are doing with their walking style that's different to their, say, facial appearance or their voice, is that they're concealing ovulation from a distance. So if you're a distance from a woman, pretty much all you can tell by looking at her is how she's walking. You know, say if you're like 100 yards away or something like that, all you can really tell about her, you can't see her skin tone, you can't see her hair too well maybe, but you can see how she's walking. Maybe women in that case are concealing ovulation completely and saying, no, almost to say, no, nothing to see here. Don't need to find me more attractive, because they're in the fertile phase, and it's really important at that phase of the cycle that women choose the best partners, you know, because if they choose a subpar partner, there's more chance they're going to become pregnant, and they've wasted basically a whole year on a baby they could have had with someone who was higher up the pecking order, if that makes sense. The researchers in it for this paper hypothesized that, so close up, women might be advertising ovulation a little bit, you know, if you're in the immediate social environment of a woman and she's chosen to be near to you, then she might say, hey, I'm ovulating now, you know, I look more attractive, you know, that's something I want to advertise to you. But if you're the type of person who's far away, if I'm keeping you at arm's length, maybe I don't want to advertise that I'm fertile. So that's the kind of rationalization that the authors of that paper used. And it's only in the last month or so that another paper has come out looking at women's body movements and stage of the cycle. And so in that we see the opposite effect, what we'd expect from the results that we've seen for clothing and seen for facial appearance. We find that women in the fertile phase have more attractive gait. So those two papers sort of contradict one another. And if anyone listening wants to kind of work out which of those two studies is better, I advise them to read them. It's pretty difficult to really go into the methods of them too much and to compare them. So there's a bit of a controversy over whether really body movements are related to conception risk, as we call it, probability of becoming pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that you pointed out first the first paper and the rationalization, and then the contradicting paper, which sort of emphasizes the way science works and that there are attempts at replication. And then when we try to reproduce results, sometimes we get something different and we find we can come up with some theoretical post hoc explanation for whatever we find.
And that's the tricky thing sometimes. I think now there are so many papers that have been published that demonstrate that women's appearance or behavior varies over the menstrual cycle such that they become more attractive in various modalities when they're ovulating. There are so many of those papers out there now that any paper that shows the opposite finding, as this first gait paper I was talking about did, immediately peer reviewers are going to see that and go, hey, that's not what we expected. Is this paper done? Is this paper, this study been run correctly? And so you do start to wonder whether there may be some papers that people have found it difficult to publish because they don't really confirm what we've come to expect from the literature. So yeah, that is difficult, and it's hard to know what research people have done but found difficult to publish.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to avoid all bias. Well, one study I liked because it had a sort of real world context, it was a study of lap dancers, and apparently they make more money and when they're ovulating in tips, right?
Yeah, I think that study came out in 2007, and that's a study by Jeffrey Miller. And so that got a lot of play in the media because that was a really fascinating study. And that really, like you say, it was a real world example. A lot of the research to do with women's appearance over the cycle is done in the lab. Like I say, you take photographs of people or you record their voices and that kind of thing. And then you present these recordings or photographs to men and see which ones they prefer. But what Miller did in this study is he went to a strip club and he asked all the strippers in the strip club. I mean, could you imagine how I don't know how he got ethical approval to do this study, but okay. So he, I mean,
from his wife especially.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But he went down to the strip club, or he sent his students. Someone drew straws, and someone drew the lucky straw, and they went down to the strip club, and they got all these strippers to keep a diary of the tips they received over, I think 2 months, and also to keep track of their menstrual cycle. So they kept track of when their periods began, and so the researchers could use that information to work out, you know, when over the period of 2 months they were ovulating and when they were in the lower fertility phase. And so the researchers found that women who were in the fertile phase, they made more tips. They made more money from the customers of this strip club. And because they were testing these results over the whole month, they were able to look during menses. I think they found that the strippers made the least money. And then during around about ovulation, they made the most money. And then a week or so later in the luteal phase, when they weren't as, their fertility wasn't as high, they made somewhere about the middle range of tips. So this sort of backs up the laboratory findings, because if we assume that the reason why men give the women bigger tips is because they find them more attractive, well, that makes sense, because in the lab we find that women who are in the fertile phase, they appear more attractive. So we know to some extent that these findings we get in the laboratory, they do have some sort of relevance to the real world. Now, of course, you know, the average, what we would call the mating market, how people normally meet partners and how they normally behave towards them, it's not the same as a strip club, of course. But what the strip club experiment does show is that men are actually willing to part with money, probably for no better reason than they find the person attractive. And so we really know that they do find those people more attractive. Otherwise, they would keep hold of their money. It's not the case that they're just tapping buttons in a laboratory experiment. So it seems that the effect is genuine.
Yeah, it's very believable. I guess it would be even better if we had it tried at other locations with slight variations, right?
Yeah.
Reproduce it more, but still pretty convincing.
The one problem with that study is that we don't know exactly what it is about the women that the men are picking up on. So if we do a study in the laboratory, we've got lots of control over it. And if we show people photographs and we find a difference in how attractive the photographs are across the cycle, we know it's because of the photograph. You know, it can't be voice, or it can't be dancing ability, or it can't be how you do your hair or anything like that, because we've only shown neutral expression photographs. In the strip club, it could be lots of different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make a quick clarification, if you can inform me, about the timing of ovulation and menses and the luteal phase, the non-fertile period. I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Okay, so we normally start counting the days of a menstrual cycle from the first day of menses. So the day that a woman begins her period, we would class that as day one. And the average cycle length is 28 days. Lots of women will have longer cycles than that and shorter cycles than that, which is perfectly normal. But if we average it out, it's around about 28 days. So menses will occur first. And that usually lasts, 5 or 6 days. That, again, lots of natural variation in there, in the length of menses. And then ovulation will tend to occur around about day 14 or so, 13, 14. And that's what we call the follicular phase. The follicular phase of the cycle is going from the end of menses through to ovulation. And then after ovulation, we have the luteal phase, where fertility gets lower until the end of the cycle, and then the whole thing starts again. So what a lot of us are told in high school sex education classes is that women can become pregnant at any time of the cycle, so be careful, kids, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people go through their life thinking that's totally true, but women can only really become pregnant in the few days preceding ovulation, because it's at ovulation, the egg's released, and if the sperm are there, then fertilization can occur. But sperm can only survive a few days inside the reproductive tract, so a few days after ovulation, that's it, the game's up until the next month. So if women were able to become pregnant throughout the whole cycle, then we probably wouldn't see any change in their mate preferences or anything like that at all. It's because women can only really become pregnant for a very short window that mm-hmm. gives rise to what we call the mixed mating strategy and changes in women's preferences and that kind of thing.
Yeah, very interesting that you point out the sex ed assumptions. I guess the problem is it would take a lot of effort for people to track their cycles and make sure that they have very regular cycles. So it wouldn't be the safest contraception method.
And I don't know what it was like, you know, when you were at school. When I was at school, you know, the boys didn't get any education about female fertility or anything like that. So, you know, all I knew about it at that age was what my female friends would tell me they'd heard in their sex ed class. But, you know, a lot of my female friends, even as they went into adulthood, they would go, no, you know, I heard in sex ed class that you can get pregnant at any time. And really it's because I guess what's happening is the teachers just don't want the kids to have sex, right? So they want to make sure people are careful and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, now that we're so well informed about the menstrual cycle and even a little bit of sex ed on the side, the last question I had about the cycling was how women's sexual fantasies are affected.
Yeah. So I personally haven't done any research on women's sexual fantasies per se, but some of the researchers working in the area and some of my colleagues have done that. And what we find is that when women are in the fertile phase of their cycle, they'll tend to have more fantasies about what we call extra pair partners, basically men who they're not actually with at that point in time. Mm. We hypothesize that that's probably because it's at that stage of the cycle that women have the most to gain from mating with other, perhaps more genetically superior men. So if women have more fantasies about those kind of guys when they're more likely to become pregnant, then they're more likely to act on those fantasies and to mate with those guys. And in fact, we do see women are more likely to go to nightclubs and to places where they're likely to meet single men when they're in the fertile phase of their cycle. So presumably they are acting more on their fantasies then. So one thing I've thought in this last couple of months, where books like 50 Shades of Grey, you know, apparently everyone's reading that book now, and I've seen a lot of newspaper articles linking the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon to that film Magic Mike that's come out, that, you know, about, was it Matthew McConaughey and is his name Channing Tatum?
That is his name.
As strippers. And so a lot of people have been linking those two things together and saying, you know, there seems to be like an outlet for female fantasy that people haven't really talked about it that much before. So now it's getting a lot of media attention. And it sort of occurred to me, maybe it'd be interesting to see, you know, what time of the month people are buying these books and buying tickets to go and see films like Magic Mike. And are people, you know, more likely to do those kind of things in the fertile phase or not? And yeah, that'll be a nice test of whether people are really sort of behaving that way in real life rather than just reports in a lab, you know, just reporting how they say.
Yeah, there's a nice testable prediction. Maybe you can get the Amazon data miners to ask people what stage their menstrual cycle they're in.
Stop drafting my emails to Amazon.
Unfortunately, I don't think the big corporations are always sharing their data so freely. But
you could hang around in the front door of Borders or a bookstore and, you know, ask women. And there's the researchers who do that. You know, there's a guy called Nicolas Gagen who works in France, who's done some great field studies of menstrual cycle preference shifts. We call them shifts in preference that women have. And he's just had men go up to women at university campuses in France and, you know, ask them for their phone number or ask them out on a date. And then depending on whether the women say yes or no, they've got, you know, the guy's got his data there. And then he asks, oh, by the way, you know, I'm doing some research. And by the way, you know, where are you in your cycle? So, I mean, I can imagine that being quite a tricky question to broach on a campus. But there are some researchers who are doing it, so I guess it is possible.
Yeah.
It's not for me, but I guess some researchers are doing it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it's great to do field research and to try to innovate, as long as you don't step on too many toes, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are, of course, some other factors that affect attractiveness aside from what cycle someone's in or even their appearance. And one that I noticed from your latest Olympics-themed podcast was men's participation in sport, which is more voluntary or more conscious. right? They exert some effort over that. So how does men's sporting ability and effort affect their attractiveness?
Okay, so there was a study out in the last few weeks by Gillian Brewer, and she was looking at competitive sport and participation in sport amongst men and how that affects their attractiveness to women. And so her prediction, I guess, was that the more sport a man partakes in, the more attractive he'd be to a woman, because women tend to value traits like motivation and ambition that men tend not to value or to be attracted to in women. But what she found is that just simple participation in sport by men didn't make them more attractive. What made men more attractive is if they competed in really competitive sport and if they competed in an aggressive fashion. So a pickup game of basketball, you know, might keep you trim, might keep off the pounds, but that's not necessarily what women find attractive. You're more likely to appear more attractive if, you know, you're really going for it and you're playing not necessarily elite sport, but just you're playing really competitive sport where you're being aggressive and, you know, you're jumping for the ball so they go out of bounds and that kind of thing, I guess. To some extent, that's not really about being involved in sport or being sporty. It's really about being competitive. We might expect to see that outside sport. But there have been some investigations of attractiveness and sport in elite sportsmen. A guy called Justin Carre a couple of years ago, he showed that elite hockey players who are more competitive and are more aggressive, and I think he measured that in fact by the number of penalty minutes that the hockey players accrued on average. Those guys tend to have a more facially masculine and some might say more attractive face. And I think there's also been some research done on quarterbacks, which has shown that quarterbacks with better, I think they call it passer ratings. I don't really understand that much about American football, but I guess if like the better a quarterback is, the more attractive his face is. So you can look at those things independently amongst women who might not recognize the quarterbacks from their photographs, but they can rate them for attractiveness, and the more attractive guys tend to be better.
Interesting.
Yeah, so there's sort of links between aggressiveness, competitiveness, and also we possibly, given this quarterback finding, there might be a link between genetic superior fitness, that kind of thing. It's just more masculinity and more skill in the sporting arena and facial attractiveness too. Not necessarily masculinity, but attractiveness.
Mm-hmm. And again, that hints at sort of the colder evolutionary rationale behind what we find attractive.
Yeah, exactly. So, but like you say, though, with the sports thing, that's something that people can control. So it's a lot of the findings that we get within attractiveness psychology, they tend to be things that people really have no conscious control over. But, you know, we can all choose to be more competitive.
Yeah, when I was hearing about that in your podcast, I felt a little better about having done Taekwondo for many years, and I did sparring. Sparring is inherently aggressive and competitive. You're kicking the other person and try to get more points. So
that's interesting, yeah, because my partner did Taekwondo in university, and she was she specialized in doing the patterns.
Forms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, you call them forms. Okay, okay. She would do these forms or patterns where she would, it's almost like, I guess, like a dance routine. There's no opponent.
Yeah, it's a memorized sequence of blocks and kicks. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if you did a study of that, you might expect to see women preferring guys who engage in the competitive version of the sport rather than doing the forms, even though they both show a similar level of ability and prowess. But yeah, like you say, it's something that you can work on. So many of the studies, especially when I'm doing the podcast, it's very rarely good news for people who aren't naturally attractive. So it can be tricky sometimes to try and not leave people thinking, oh, shucks, you know, I'm getting the raw end of this every single time.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of other things that seem more fair that can affect attractiveness. It's a subjective what's fair and what isn't fair. But for example, personality or intelligence, maybe even creativity and wealth. Wealth might seem potentially unfair, but at least it's something you could work for,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So what most researchers have found is that, particularly if we're looking at women's preferences, something like wealth is ridiculously important. It's the most important factor, really. And of course, I hasten to add that, you know, everyone's different and everyone's got their own preferences, unique preferences. But just on average, if we take a huge number of women and we ask them, what do you value in a partner? Things like something like wealth really tends to come out quite high. And especially if you compare it to how important men find it. So men typically do not care whether a woman has a nickel in her pocket or 100,000. It just generally makes no difference to the extent that it makes for women. So we tend to find that's a lot more important than physical appearance when women judge attractiveness. Not necessarily for short-term relationships though. So a guy who's got a lot of money, he might not find it easier to get a lot of short-term relationships.
One-night stands sort
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense if you as I've said earlier, you know, that if women are looking for a short-term fling, they tend to prefer characteristics that are related to health or genetic superiority. And perhaps wealth isn't one of those characteristics. So if a woman becomes pregnant by a guy who's rich or a guy who's poor, might not make any difference to the offspring she produces, so she probably shouldn't pay attention to that characteristic. But if women are looking for a long-term partner, in that case, wealthiness does tend to be more important. And as I've already said, ambition tends to be quite important when women are judging for long-term partners. When men judge partners, ambition not so much important.
Mm-hmm. The sad listeners of your podcasts, if they're really trying to, it could be a consolation or something to work on to be ambitious and competitive and seek wealth.
Yeah, and of course it also depends on what kind of partner you're interested in. So we do find that more attractive women, more physically attractive women, tend to value wealth more. And so, yeah, it kind of depends. Although what we tend to see is that, I mean, there was a lot of researchers in this area, I think, used to think that we were all trying to maximize the attractiveness of our potential partners. In other words, every guy, no matter who he is or no matter what his individual qualities are, everyone should be trying to pair up with someone like Anne Hathaway or some other super attractive woman. But that might not necessarily be the case, and we might actually be better off aiming for someone who's in our own league, you know? Mm-hmm. And we actually might find those people more attractive than people who would generally be agreed to be more attractive, to be more objectively attractive, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So although people can aim to increase their own attractiveness in various ways, they might not end up with someone they really do find attractive themselves. So it can perhaps, you know, blow up in your face, really.
So I guess what you're pointing out is that even though we can talk about sort of average attractiveness that is assigned to a person by others, we can do surveys and show them a bunch of faces and say, how attractive does this seem? Everyone's answers are going to be slightly different, right? And there's still some subjectivity to it.
Yeah, there's still some subjectivity to it. And a lot of it is just based on your own knowledge of your own mate value. You know, if you know how attractive you are on various characteristics, you know, if you know what your bank balance is, if you know what you look like when you look in the mirror, if you know how intelligent you are or what your personality is, then that keys into what you want from a partner as well. And unconsciously, that's to do with what you can achieve in a partner, you know, realistically what you can hope to achieve. But consciously, you might actually prefer someone who's in your league to someone who's not. And that's not to say that, you know, if you're a guy of middling attractiveness, you're going to look at someone who's super attractive and say, I don't find that person attractive. No, of course you recognize that they are, but you might actually, given the choice in the real world, prefer to be with, you know, a girl next door type than the supermodel type, because on the whole, your relationship will be more stable and that kind of thing. So we see that men who are with women who are much more physically attractive than they are, their jealousy is really high because they're really worried that their partner will leave them. And that leads to a less stable relationship. So yeah, if people match their partners on all these characteristics as they're weighed up differently by individual people, then they're more likely to have a stable and satisfactory relationship.
Mm-hmm. So some kind of like coping mechanism going on there.
Yeah, I guess partially, yeah.
Well, as we're talking about the subjectivity of attractiveness a bit, I'm wondering about people who might be hard to explain within the framework of evolutionary psychology? I mean, first of all, just alternate sexualities, like people who are gay or bisexual. And then there are, of course, people who might be transgender. And there's we can find a territory of people whose attractions are so out of the mainstream that it seems like we can only describe them as some kind of byproduct or side effect, and that there isn't a direct evolutionary rationale for their preferences.
Yeah. I mean, there was some speculation a small while back that that homosexuality might actually be evolutionarily beneficial, if because we know that men are more likely to be gay if they have several older brothers, and we think there might be some hormonal reason for that to occur. And if that's the case, and you're more likely to be gay if you're a younger brother, is one of the reasons that you are gay, evolutionarily speaking, because you can then invest in your elder siblings' offspring rather than your own, and that kind of thing, and therefore produce sort of more inclusive fitness for your family. I don't think that hypothesis is really getting much traction at the moment, but I think you are right that alternative sexualities and that kind of thing, they tend to be underrepresented in the research literature. And that's partially because it's difficult to generate hypotheses about those populations. You know, if we think, okay, a gay guy choosing a partner, well, they can't actually have kids. So how could evolution act on those preferences? It's difficult to see. So sometimes it's just a case that we can't really generate testable hypotheses. And I think also another problem we have is just the number of people who don't identify as heterosexual is quite small. There aren't that many people percentage-wise, you know? So if you're designing a study and you want to try and get participants to come into the lab to do the study, but you specifically want, say, bisexual men, you are going to have a tough time getting those people through the doors, because there just aren't as many as them as you would like to do the study. So there are various reasons why people haven't done it. And it's a shame there aren't more studies, just because, I mean, quite often if you'll see a news story about some aspect of heterosexual mate preferences, you'll scroll down and you'll see comments from people saying, well, hey, why aren't these researchers looking at lesbians or gays? And it really is because often it's difficult to generate hypotheses, and it's difficult to recruit the participants. There has been some research done on partner preferences in gay and lesbians. And one of the surprising things is that to some extent, the preferences are similar to those you would expect to see in straight people. They're similar to the preferences you would expect to see in straight people of the same sex, and sometimes the same as preferences you would expect to see in straight people of the opposite sex.
Right.
We see that gay men tend to value youth, a youthful appearance in their partner, which is something that straight men value in women.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something that straight men are usually used to having to signal to women. You know, usually straight men don't have to worry about how youthful they look in the same way that straight women tend to. And it seems that gay men have to. So there are some things we might expect and some things we don't. But yeah, it tends to be something that evolutionary psychologists don't look at, because within our framework, it's quite tricky to really explain any findings we get and provide context for it.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully that's changing. There have been a few papers in the last couple of years, and hopefully there'll be some more.
Yeah, and even if it's tough to generate hypotheses, I'd just be interested in seeing more data and then...
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. Mm. A lot of the interesting studies that have been done in non-heterosexuals, they've just been straight replications of the studies we've already done in heterosexual participants, and we just want to see what happens in the other population. And I think, like you say, it's just interesting sometimes to see the data.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to that. It might be easier on your side of the pond. In the U.S., there's still some stigma. I live in the South, so it'd be a little tough to find self-identified bisexual or gay lesbian
people. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, sometimes on university campuses, it's not so bad. I mean, when I was at Penn State, we ran a study on gays and lesbians there, and it wasn't super tricky because it's a big campus and you've got a big LGBTQ. I'd never know which order those letters go in. It changes from place to place, but there was quite a big group there. So yeah, just because it's a big campus in general. So, you know, there's more students of every stripe. So whereas in the UK, the campuses tend to be smaller. It's definitely something that if researchers had the motivation to look at, they would be able to. But sometimes it's easier just to do the research that's easy, mm-hmm. you know, that takes a little bit less effort. So people don't tend to make the effort as much as they perhaps could.
Coming back to some things that have been studied, facial appearance doesn't only affect your mate value. It can also affect how you're viewed in other contexts, right? So, for example, if you're a politician trying to have people vote for you, or you're in court, you're the defendant, and you might be convicted, or you're asking for probation, your appearance will affect things. So how does that work?
Yeah, so like you say, there are effects of attractiveness that are not in the sort of mating sphere. Because the face is a really salient social signal. It's the first thing we notice about people, and it's impossible to look at a face and not identify it as attractive or unattractive. It's really difficult to put those kind of things out of mind. So we find that if people are defendants in court, their attractiveness can play a really big role in both how culpable they're seen, how guilty people think they are, and also the sentence that they get for their crime. So attractive people tend to fare better. If you're an attractive defendant, you'll tend to fare better. And often it's because there's this halo effect for attractive people. You know, people unconsciously, if you look at an attractive person, you think, hey, they're attractive. They must be great across the board. Everything about them must be brilliant. And someone like that, you know, they couldn't be guilty. And again, not necessarily a conscious thing. We just feel better about attractive people, and so we're less likely to see them as being guilty. Although I guess one silver lining, you know, if you're not a supermodel, is that attractive people can actually be seen as more guilty if the crime that the trial is about mm-hmm. is a fraud case. You know, if it's something to do with, say, a confidence scam or that kind of thing. If someone is attractive, then maybe the juror there goes, okay, this person's attractive. Maybe they've used their attractiveness somehow to win over the confidence of the victim in this case. And so perhaps there's more chance of this person being guilty. So in that respect, it's not necessarily the attractiveness. Attractiveness equals lower perceived culpability. More that we use attractiveness to kind of work out, well, hey, let me just imagine how this crime would have played out.
So if you're a Ponzi schemer, you might not want to have such a symmetric face.
Yeah, because, yeah, exactly. You might think, oh, this guy's so charming. Of course they convinced people to invest in the scheme. But in terms of politics, I mean, there we definitely know that appearance is really important. And it's unfortunate, really, because what we would like to see is that politicians are judged entirely on their policies. And often politicians will say, you know, you judge me on my policies. I don't want to be a personality politician or, you know, anything like that. Judge me on my policies. But they, of course, know, you know, they've done the polls, they've done the research. And they're totally aware that appearance is important. I mean, you can look at anecdotes of, I think it was a Ukrainian election a few years back, and there were a couple of candidates up for the president. And one of the candidates was poisoned, I think, and the poison that this guy was given, it affected his appearance, and it gave him this skin condition. So, you know, people are aware that these kind of things are important, and I mean, that's obviously an extreme example of how other people can take advantage of it. But some of the research that we've done on this, we did it a few years back, and we found that appearance is really important in judging the likely success of various candidates in elections. So what we did in our study is we took photographs of the party leaders or presidential candidates in relevant countries, took photographs of them. So say, you know, George Bush and John Kerry, or Tony Blair and William Hague, or their equivalents in Australia, New Zealand and Canada. Because we have data for those people in terms of which party won or which candidate won.
Right.
And what we did then is we showed the photographs to participants. But before we did that, we didn't just show them the plain photographs, because, of course, world leaders are usually quite recognizable. We disguised the photographs by combining them with just an average male, or actually, I think in one case, an average female face, because I think in an Australian election, there was one election where it was two women were the candidates. So, mm-hmm. so, but most of the time it was a man versus another man. We would combine them with average male faces. So when we show these faces to people, they can't recognize who they are. There's just certain changes in face shape that make them more similar or dissimilar to various party leaders. And then we ask the participants to look at the faces and say, if you had to choose one of these two people to run your country, which one of them would you choose? And so they vote for one or the other. And then when we look at the results, we find that the percentage of votes that we get from our participants really closely matches the percentage of votes the candidates received in the real life election. And so we found this for, I think, several presidential elections in the US and several going back in the UK and all over the world. So it appears that if perhaps people aren't only using facial appearance to judge politicians, but if we were to only use facial appearance, we could make a really good estimate of the final results in the election. And this seems to be something that politicians around the world are realizing as politicians become increasingly visible in media. They seem to be getting younger and definitely more attractive, I would say. You know, if you look at some of the British prime ministers from 20 or 30 years ago, you know, not a lot of those guys are particularly good looking, but politicians these days getting a lot more polished. And I think partly it's because their parties are beginning to realize, you know, you need to look a certain way to win an election, which is kind of a shame, really.
Yeah, quite scary stuff, just to think how accurate predicting an election could be with
face. It really was very accurate. An extra finding we got, which is quite surprising to us, really, we showed people a pair of faces that were based on George Bush and John Kerry. So this was, at the time we ran the study, it was before Obama was elected. So it was the most recent election we had data for. Mm-hmm. We showed people faces of that were related to George Bush and John Kerry. And we said, okay, imagine your country is at war. Which of these two faces would make, you know, a better leader for your country? And then we had a separate group of participants imagine that their country was a time of peace, and who would they choose then? And we found an overwhelming majority of people voted for the George Bush-like face when they imagined their country was under conditions of war, and a huge preference for the John Kerry face when they imagined their country was at a time of peace. And when we didn't ask people to imagine any kind of scenario, just, you know, just go ahead and imagine who you would vote for, it was quite close.
Huh.
And I think this really sort of seems to back up people's ideas about how that election played out, because of course the war was a really big policy issue, I think, in that election.
No doubt. Mm-hmm.
And definitely George Bush was trying to play up the war at that time. So yeah, it looks like politicians are definitely aware of this, but they don't want to appear to be aware of it, because I guess it undermines, you know, policy issues and that kind of thing, or the importance they want to pretend to place on policy issues, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And I think also if the public aren't really aware of this propensity they have to judge people on appearance, they're less likely to take it seriously, as perhaps as seriously as they probably should take it. I think there was a really interesting case, I don't know if you're aware of this one, from, I think, was it the early 60s when Nixon was up against JFK. I don't know the exact date of the election, but there was that really interesting finding that if people saw the debate between Nixon and Kennedy on TV, they thought that Kennedy had won because Nixon appeared, I think he had, you know, a sweaty brow and he appeared a bit more nervous. And of course, you know, JFK is a good looking guy. And then compared that to the results from the radio broadcast of that debate, you know, people thought Nixon had won. If it was just the audio, so definitely appearances can play a huge, huge part.
I wonder how this interview would be perceived if it were video instead of audio. It'd be a whole different thing.
That's the who might mind my sweaty brow, but I blame it on the hot weather in the UK, so I'd be okay.
I'm very sweaty over here as well. This July, I believe, that just passed was the hottest month on record in the United States.
Wow.
So very sweaty brows over here. You were talking about facial appearances affecting politicians, and I was reminded of a pop culture reference. When I was watching the last Star Wars, the newest one, the episode 3, I was baffled that like the whole galaxy would follow this man who was so facially deformed. He just had the evil written all over his face.
Yeah.
They just hand over the reins of the Empire to him.
Oh yeah, that was so funny. It's just like the guy comes in after his face has been zapped to a crisp. And he's like, and he's got the evil voice too, you know, he comes in with the evil voice and he's like, hey, I'm a monster, how about you make me the Supreme Commander? And everyone's just clapping away, like, yeah, sure. And I don't think that was the only problem with that film, but it was definitely something that that was noticeable.
Well, it was wartime, mind you, so maybe all those masculine characteristics.
Yeah, let's get this monster in and he'll smash the enemies. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe George Lucas is cleverer than I'm giving him credit, but I don't know.
I have my doubts.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to circle back to finish this discussion on the different implications of your field of research. First of all, I mean, we've talked a little bit about how it can be a little soul-crushing for men who aren't that attractive, or for women who are objectified in certain ways.
Yeah.
But it's something we can put up with, right? There's the world of natural selection. We're just describing things. It's different from our set of values. We've navigated that a bit. What I'm curious that we haven't talked about as much is, how much does the politics affect the mentality of psychologists in your field? Do you feel like, maybe comparing to a field like biblical studies, how much would you say there are agendas in your field, or sort of ulterior motives, compared to people who are trying to prove something about Jesus or whatnot?
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess amongst researchers in my field, I don't feel like there tend to be a lot of motives to kind of prove one thing or the other. But I mean, I guess with something like, say, the research that I was involved with on contraceptive pill, that's a lot more sort of applied research than I've been used to doing in the past. It sort of has real world implications. You know, if we find something in a certain direction compares to another, well, that might mean effectively we're suggesting people take or don't take the pill. So that's tricky. And I think sometimes, you know, when you're doing that kind of research, you have to think, what are my own personal opinions about the pill? You know, and I think it's tricky because, of course, as a scientist, you know, if you find something positive about the pill or negative about it, you should just publish it regardless, right? I mean, you should just publish it because the truth is the truth. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I think researchers in my area, they tend not to have any agenda they're pushing, although perhaps, you know, I'm not the best person to judge that because I'm stuck right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. Although often I feel like outsiders from the study of attractiveness, and also people who don't study human behavior from an evolutionary perspective like I do, they will often characterize evolutionary psychologists as being genetic determinists, you know? So they'll say, oh, well, if you're saying people behave this way, well, that's rubbish because people, there's culture, and, you know, it's not just nature, there's nurture. People aren't just automata. People also interact with their environment. And so I feel like sometimes we do get misrepresented in that sense because, you know, we're not genetic determinists, and a lot of these preferences that I've talked with you about today, they're variable preferences, you know, they're to do with how preferences change over time and how people can differ in their preferences. So we do find differences in preferences for all different kinds of things, and we can investigate those from an evolutionary perspective and bring in information about the environment and culture. Sometimes people who work predominantly from a cultural perspective, I feel like they don't always appreciate that we look at it from that way. And often I think what we're also sometimes accused of is suggesting that if this is how we see people behaving, if this is how we see preferences playing out, that it's almost as if we're saying this is how they should play out. You know, I think sometimes critics, they commit what we call the naturalistic fallacy, and they say, well, if you're saying people behave this way, then they should behave this way, and that's what's right. And of course, we don't do that at all. You know, we try and present findings totally impartially, and just because someone behaves a certain way doesn't mean we morally think it's the correct way or the incorrect way. As you've already mentioned, a lot of the results that we find in terms of attractiveness psychology, they can be a little bit disheartening because it makes people seem like they're behaving in ways that aren't particularly moral. Mm-hmm. But if we know about those kind of things, then we can perhaps do something to change it, because unlike other animals, we have conscious control over our behavior, and we can not necessarily behave in the way that evolution wants us to if we would prefer not to.
Yeah. This idea of the naturalistic fallacy comes up in pretty much all psychology research that has some disheartening aspect to it. I'm reminded of Dan Ariely's research on lying. He's over here in North Carolina at Duke University. And basically, he just points out that through various studies on college campuses, he can get people to lie in their own interest. And in fact, most people will lie a little bit to gain a little bit extra money or whatnot. And so people will accuse him of saying, well, are you saying lying is good, or you should lie for personal gain? And no, that's not what he's saying.
Yeah, or that he's saying that, like, it's an excuse, you know. Right, I found some data that say people sometimes behave this way. So if you do behave this way, if you do lie, then here's your excuse, and you're free to behave however you want. And I think a lot of the times, I mean, there are some researchers who do research on attractiveness, and they couple it with research on sexual abuse and rape. And sometimes people will sort of have a visceral reaction to that line of research, and they'll say, you know, you can't do research on men's propensity to rape, because if you do that, you're providing an excuse for men to commit sexual abuse. And of course, it's doing some research and producing data that shows how the world is not the same as saying, hey, if you do this behavior, it's totally fine, and here's your excuse, you know. So those can sometimes be difficult things that come up when people discuss the research. And working in science on an everyday basis, they're not things you tend to think about, because you're used to not looking at it that way at all, you know. So sometimes you can be surprised when the media gets hold of a story, and you think, hey, that's not how I looked at this at all, you know. And your research can sometimes be twisted to appear in ways that you hadn't really contemplated. And I think that's especially true of people who work in the area that I do, in attractiveness psychology, because it attracts a lot of media interest, you know, because if we produce work that's to do with, say, women's body shape, I mean, that's going to get a lot of play in the media, because it's a story that journalists know people are going to want to read about.
Definitely. What's the thrust of your interest in evolutionary psychology, attractiveness? And it seems like it's not, I want to find out how to become a more attractive person, right?
No.
It's very different from the media angles.
Yeah. I mean, often if I've done some research and I do a radio interview or something like that, people will say, well, how do you use these data in the real world? Or, you know, they want to know about your individual preferences. Or I did some research on facial scars a couple of years back, and the results of that study showed that men with facial scars tend to be more attractive to women as short-term partners. And I was being interviewed about this research, and the researcher said, well, have you got a facial scar? And I was rather embarrassed to have to tell him that I do. But and he thought, hey, I've got this guy pegged, you know, I know why he did this study. And I'd like to think that has nothing to do with why I ran the study, you know. But I can understand why he would think that. But I mean, and it might have been, you know, it might have been an inspiration for why I decided to do the study. But I like to think I've got no vested interest in how the results came out. But really, my interest in attractiveness psychology, well, at first, I mean, it came from just the pure chance of the university courses that I took, you know. So I did a master's at Liverpool University on evolutionary psychology, and I got interested in various aspects of attractiveness psychology and some of the menstrual cycle work while I was there. But over time, I've come to think that attractiveness psychology, the question that it really answers is, it tells us about one of the most important decisions that any of us will make in our lives, really, which is, who do I settle down with and start a family with, you know? And there are very few researchers that really tackle that question. And although often there can be a bit of, friendly discussion amongst them, not just psychologists, but all kinds of scientists, about whose field is the most important and whose field is provides the most benefit to mankind and all that kind of thing.
Right.
And sometimes it's difficult to argue that attractiveness psychology really has the greatest benefit, because a lot of the time, you know, I'm not going to lie, you know, that one of the main reasons I got involved in it, because it's interesting and it's fun, you know. If I was the sort of person who could cope with looking through a telescope for years on end in the hope that I would find a moon with water on it, then I guess I would have done that. And more power to the people who are able to do that. But I guess I haven't got the concentration to do that kind of science. But I do genuinely think, you know, it helps us to answer questions about what it really is to be human and to make those decisions that often people sort of take for granted. We don't really think about why we choose partners. We just find people attractive, mm-hmm. and that's it really. But there's definitely more to it. As with most areas of science, the more you find out, the more interesting it becomes, and the more questions crop up, and the more research that you want to do. So I'm committed.
So it's the interest of the unknown, all these different mysteries to untangle and figuring out are what would seem like very fluffy, subjective feelings. And I know that you like to have fun from your podcast. Here's a direct quote I'd like to throw back at you. you're talking about men and how they have trouble detecting if a child is theirs or not, that they just tend to think any child resembles them. And your comment on this was, sleep with whoever you like, have a kid, and he'll never know the difference.
Yeah. So the format of my podcast, as you'll know, is I'll talk about some new research that's come out in the last month. And I tend to go into the studies with a bit of depth. And then in the end, I'll try and usually fail in a sort of David Brent from The Office fashion to make a joke out of it. Mm. But often, like, you know, as we've said, that some of the findings from these attractiveness studies can be kind of like, oh, wow, that's how people are. I sometimes find it amusing to try and present the hypothetical advice that someone would give from the conclusions of a particular study. And often the advice that you would give is extremely immoral and you would not want anyone to take.
Hmm.
If we look at the results of that particular study that I was talking about there, I mean, that's what the results seem to suggest. You know, if you were going to take it utterly literally and look at it from a hard-nosed evolutionary point of view,
yeah,
then that's what women would do. They would sleep with whoever they like, would have a kid, and not worry about whether it resembled their partner because he can't tell. So, yeah. I really hope I haven't got this unknown hidden audience out there who goes, oh, sure, like writing it down in their little black book of Rob's advice, you know?
Well, with the internet, it's hard to know.
You never know.
Yeah, there's this whole genre of YouTube video and advice online that's just pickup artists giving men advice.
Yeah, there is definitely that whole subculture of like the game or all those type of things. And all that kind of thing is so scary because apart from anything else, apart from the fact that it sort of advocates essentially immoral behavior, a lot of it is just based on spurious rubbish, you know, nothing to do with real research at all. Mm. I mean, even things that you would think are less dodgy, things like just internet dating sites and their so-called like compatibility factors, you know, and you put in your interests and someone else puts in their interests and we'll hook you up with people. And a lot of that stuff is just based on zero research. They're essentially just pairing you up with people at random, or at the very least, they're pairing you up with people according to traits that aren't really that important when it comes to selecting a partner. So yeah, very little of this research has really been applied by people who, for whatever reason, would probably benefit from applying it. But yeah.
Maybe that's a good thing.
I think probably that's the case, yeah, for some of these people.
Okay. I thought it was interesting you mentioned on the radio, someone asked you, do you have a facial scar? Sort of like discrediting your research immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a man with a facial scar proving that facial scar is attractive. And of course, that story is not fair to all the effort you've put in and to the objectivity that you are striving to achieve. But at the same time, I think it is worth exploring how even researchers at universities who don't watch that much TV and don't think like mainstream media, how they're still human and fallible.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
One sort of parable that runs parallel to this, relating to sexism and sexist assumptions, is this paper by an anthropologist I read recently, and I'll stick it up on the website for our podcast because I don't remember the author. But this anthropologist was looking at how conception has been described by biologists in past decades. And starting the 40s, 50s, what we saw was a description of the sperm as little warriors.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Described in terms of their strength and speed, penetrating the egg and sort of masculinizing them and making them the prime agents. And the egg just sitting there ready to be taken. And as it turns out, that wasn't really what the science bore out. It took a while for the biologists to adjust their language and assumptions. And really, finally in the 90s, they started to see that the forward propulsion of the sperm was so little that it was basically the egg entrapping, latching onto the sperm. And they're just wiggling, almost uselessly flopping around sideways. And so it is a very different narrative. this paper was arguing that these biologists, in spite of doing good research, the questions they were asking and the language they were using was being colored by sexist assumptions, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think there's definitely potential for that in your field, just completely accidentally, unconsciously, because just through our parenting, through all the media we consume, we're potentially consuming ways of viewing the world and of viewing, in this case, women that are not completely objective.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is something that has been a problem right from the beginning. If you go back right to the beginning of attractiveness psychology, you can go back to someone like Charles Darwin, who was originally suggesting that females of various species, I mean, he was also trying to suggest that it was true in humans, but had to be a bit cagey about it, but suggesting that females choose their partners and exercise choice over who they mate with. And people didn't like that at all. They liked the idea that males were competing for a partner, but not the idea that females thought about these kind of things and were motivated to think about these kind of things. So yeah, it's definitely tricky. And often we do investigate specifically women's preferences, and mostly because they're more interesting than men's preferences. Men's preferences, it's quite easy to understand them with very little research because they tend to be so simple. Well, you know, men will prefer a more limited variety of characteristics in a partner than women will. And they're less variable in the preferences they have. So more research tends to be done on women. As with most sciences, most of the researchers will just happen to be men, because unfortunately a lot of female grad students don't carry on with their careers and they leave science. So you end up with a predominance of male researchers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely something that you have to think about. I've presented some of my research at conferences where I haven't had my traditional audience, if that's one way of putting it. You know, I haven't had colleagues or people who work in the area there.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a lot of, say, feminist theorists or people who work on women's health. And often they, you know, will find this research extremely sexist. And that's difficult for someone like me to deal with, because I, you know, I'd like to consider myself a feminist. Well, I mean, there's different ways of using that word. So, I mean, an academic feminist, I think, is a bit different to kind of what a layperson would think of as a feminist, of someone who's you know, all for equality.
Well, there's also a danger of being a feminist who's not willing to receive facts from science, right? I'm reminded of Steven Pinker's beef with people who think we're all blank slates when we're born. I think his book was titled The Blank Slate, where he was arguing that there's just an overwhelming propensity of evidence showing that people are born with certain tendencies, and they can have to do with sex or it can have to do with other things. But it even though it'd be politically convenient, potentially, to say that people can be culturally ridden to do anything, that's not quite true.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I look at it is that I would say it's not sexist to recognize differences between men and women. It's sexist to act on those differences to produce inequality. You know, so if we say that men and women are different in a certain way, there is no right or wrong to that, if that makes sense. So, you know, say if, you know, people have done research to show that men have better spatial awareness than women in general. And there's a lot of overlap, but that just seems to be the case. And then women outperform men in things like verbal reasoning. Now, if we find that that's a difference, there could be lots of reasons for that difference. You know, it could be an innate difference. There could be some environmental pressures, some cultural reasons for that difference that if we wanted to, we could do some interventions to try and equalize things. But if we just say there's a difference between the sexes here, just that simple fact of recognizing that, it's not a sexist position to take. It's just recognizing reality. Now, the sexist position to take would be to say, you know, men are better than women because of this, or women are better than men because of that. So it can be tricky sometimes, because I think sometimes we'll have people who work on attractiveness or agendas will be questioned, like, why are you asking these questions? And as you say, it can sometimes be difficult to know your motivations for following any particular line of research. Like, I mean, I'm not necessarily interested in sex differences per se, but if I find a sex difference, then, you know, I feel like I've got to report it, because if I think I've run the study well and fairly, and there's a sex difference there, say, then I sort of think there's no value judgment to be made on that. But there are some researchers who don't like that. And I think it will often be researchers who work within that framework of thinking that we are a blank slate, and every difference between the sexes or every aspect of our personality is driven by culture. And if you have that a priori position, then anytime someone proposes a sex difference, it must rankle, you know, it must make you think, oh, you know, I'm not going to accept that. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the real problem here is that a lot of researchers who work in my area and researchers who work from within a more cultural perspective, we don't interact with each other. So you end up with just science becoming completely balkanized and people not discussing their differences. And in a way, not even realizing the differences occur. I mean, like I said, I presented some menstrual cycle research at this conference, which mm-hmm. was predominantly made up of an audience who worked from a cultural perspective. It was like doing a comedy gig that was going really badly. Like, I was almost getting heckles because they were not happy. And I can imagine something similar happening at an evolutionary type conference if someone came up from another perspective. You know, I don't think it's just that group of scientists who's more likely to kick up a fuss. But I think that there is something to be said for people going and talking to each other about their research and really questioning not just the research they've done that they're up there to present, but the viewpoint that really governs all the research they do that we all often so take for granted, you know. So I just really take for granted that I apply evolutionary thinking to my research, and I don't really worry so more about whether that's something that other people will think is a great thing to do, because I'm sort of working totally within that paradigm, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think other people will be working within a different paradigm and think applying evolution to human behavior, to understand human behavior, is a totally crazy thing to do. But while we both have that point of view and we don't talk about it, then that just, you know, it creates more problems.
Yeah, and both sides potentially miss a chance to learn something. So usually the dialogue will reveal flaws on both sides.
There was a newspaper article published today in The Guardian, which was talking about a paper that was out this week in PLOS One by attractiveness researchers Viren Swamy and Martin Tovey,
mm-hmm.
which was looking at stress and how it, on men's stress, how stressed men feel and their preferences for female body size, and how if you're more stressed, you prefer a woman who's got a larger body size. And the journalist who was talking about this particular paper, she didn't like the paper, and she thought that evolutionary-based work like this, that Viren Swamy does and people like me do, doesn't really have a whole lot of value. And then when she was trying to describe why it doesn't have value, she made a whole series of mistakes in her interpretation of how evolution works. And so when you see that, it's really difficult. I could understand your criticism if you understood a bit more of the background, because if you don't get points A, B, and C, there's no way that I can listen to your arguments on points X, Y, and Z,
mm-hmm.
because you don't understand the background. And so often we don't understand each other's backgrounds. And then it just means it makes it really difficult to discuss the findings that are at hand, you know, any results that we've come up with. If we don't understand each other's perspectives, going right back to basics, it just makes it more difficult for us to really have sensible discussions. And because, you know, not just science, within psychology, definitely researchers just work totally independently of people with different perspectives now.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility for those kind of discussions, as well as the desire for them, just seems to have diminished to a level where it's no longer really productive, or as productive as it could be.
Hmm. Well, it's so hard to shut off our intuitions and our gut emotional reactions, and we often reason from those intuitions. So when two fields with very different views and assumptions talk to each other, it's hard to fully bridge that gap. But we'll keep working on it. And I hope I haven't heckled you too much and with my own reactions.
No, well, we should all be used to that, I guess, in science. So.
Yep. All right. Just to finish up, is there any study you'd like to point listeners to that is something running right now from you or a colleague?
Well, my website is oraclelab.co.uk, I should say. And there's some experiments on there, but a really great website is one run by some of my collaborators, which is faceresearch.org. and some great experiments on that. They're being updated all the time, and they've got them programmed really well. So when you finish the study, you can sort of see visualizations of how other people have performed in the study. So that's a really good one to go to as well.
Fantastic. Well, for our listeners who've made it this far, I'm Jose Dras Lopez. This is Psych Talk, and we've been talking with Rob Burris. He's an evolutionary psychologist who studies attractiveness and mate choice behaviors. He's held postdocs at Sterling and Penn State. And check out his podcast, the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. Rob, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Jose. Appreciate it.